I am mining investor and editor of Resource Stock Digest, head out of the Del Real, here with my partner, Mr. Nick Hodge, who's also an investor, of course, and the publisher of Bizarro World. It's the 370th episode of our weekly therapy session that we call Investing in Bizarro World. We're going to talk markets. We're going to talk gold, silver, bottoms, tops, yields, rotating sectors, China, critical metals. It's a lot going on out there. But first and foremost, Mr. Hodge, how was your Father's Day? How is your beautiful family? How are you doing?
That's a whole lot to talk about, Gerardo. And gosh, I've already forgotten about Father's Day. We've moved on, but it was great. Spent some time in the pool with the kids, had a nice little dinner, pretty low key. Gearing up for Hoop Fest this weekend here in Spokane, which is, as they will tell you, the world's largest 3-on-3 basketball tournament. So looking forward to that. Have the in-laws in town. It's my mother's birthday tomorrow. I should say happy birthday. And I know my dad listens as well, who got his knee replaced last week. So I talked to him earlier today. He's doing well, but a speedy recovery to him as well. How are you, Gerardo?
Oh, happy birthday to mom. Hey, dad, I'm glad you're on the mend. Hope y'all are well. Excuse the profanity. Luckily, it comes from both of us, so I don't feel as bad. No. I'm great. Listen, our middle one is settling in Alaska just fine. Our youngest, as you know, is getting ready to leave to Portland here in about a month or so, month and a half. It's summertime. It's hot. The pool is most definitely open. The wife gets prettier by the day. The wife still loves me. Those two go hand in hand. Those are good things for me. The kids are healthy. Family's good. Things are good. No complaints.
Not as hot as it is in France.
That is very, very true. And they don't have AC out there, which has led for, you know, there's a couple of influencers I follow. Hey, yes, Jules, on Twitter or X. And it's great. Jules is a brilliant, brilliant businesswoman and a great influencer and was ahead of her time with the Snapchat stuff like over a decade ago or whatever. She also happens to be extremely attractive. And she was in Paris for an event that she was hosting. And so she posted up a picture of her in a bikini and she said, excuse me if this is inappropriate, but this is how I'm walking all week long because it is hot here and they don't have AC and I wasn't expecting 100 degrees in Paris. So yeah, it's hot in Paris for sure.
I'm sure everyone smells even lovelier than usual.
Yeah, well, listen, let's get right to it. Gold had itself a heck of a week, silver as well, the dollar as well. Let's start with the metals. Gold fell below the 4,000 mark. It was... again, I know I'm probably like a masochist for this junior resource space, but a part of me smiled because there were a couple of like newsletter writers and like big time gold accounts that were like, all right, I'm out of here until September, October, folks. I can't handle this volatility. In the silver space, it was even worse, right? The capitulation there was made for some pretty good banter back and forth between perma bulls, perma bears, and everybody in between. With all that being said, gold dropped below 4,000. Bounced off what I think, and I'm going to ask you the technical levels here in a little bit, bounced off that first level of support that I was really hoping would hold, sitting at 4,033 right now. Silver fell below 60, looked like it was going down to 54, popped right back up, sitting right at 58 right now. So from a technical perspective, how is gold looking? Let's start with gold, and then we could talk about silver here in just a second. I was worried about 3915, 3913, right around that level. Bounce beautifully off of that. Hopefully it holds, right? We'll see how the weekly closes out.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty well put. I don't know if I have a ton to add there. In the short term, gold is now bullish. And I would say, you know, I'll take you through what I've said for the past couple of weeks. Copper looks better than gold, looks better than silver. And that was for a reason. And now gold's not looking so good, at least in the short term. And so I guess maybe a couple of comments before I talk about technical levels. And some of this stems from Hedgeye as well. So credit where credit is due. Like, you don't have to be all in or all out, right? Like, I can be short-term bearish on gold and still hold my core positions. I can trim around other positions that I have in the metals complex. I can know that my long-term thesis, bull thesis for gold is intact. And I can still acknowledge that in the short term, it's technically broken down, which it has. So... gold is broken down below its trend line, as you said, which was right around $4,000. The level of support I've written in my notebook is 3930. So we'll see if it tests that again. It bounced off that in the short term, as you just noted, back above 4,000. sort of unknowable if it's gonna test that again. We'll have to take it as it comes. But if it does break down through that 3930 level, I think you're gonna see 3400, 3440 pretty quickly, which is the next major area of support. It's interesting because you have a confluence of factors, right? Like a confluence is where like two rivers meet and things swirl around, and then things are swirling around, right? You've got bond yields on the short term and the long term moving in different directions. You've got the short end of the curve saying that the Fed is going to hike, begging essentially from a chart standpoint for rate hikes. The market is pricing in at least one, if not two, quarter point hikes. If not by the end of the year, then by the January meeting. That goes against the wisdom of Warsh as we knew it for the past 6 months or since his appointment, being appointed as a lapdog who was going to be dovish and cut rates. The 10-year is yield at least is going down, which is giving mixed signals again back to that confluence. Yep. That inflation is coming down on its own, and maybe the economy is going to slow, which would mean that the Fed does not need to hike rates in the next couple of months, and you still have those midterms coming up in September that, because of political pressure, Mr. Warsh is likely not going to want to hike into. And you've got commodities that have dramatically softened across the board. We talked a little bit about it last week, but oil has continued to fall and is bearish. Even copper has come down to below $6 at certain points in the past couple of weeks. Aluminum has softened. A lot of the softer agricultural commodities have softened. And that means the Warsh will likely get the cover to say, look, the inflation is coming down on its own. We might not need to hike again. I've said it in the past couple of weeks that, you know, he can't do that unilaterally, but he can certainly say what he wants to say. And we know that the words that come out of the Fed chair's mouth matter. We just had the death of Mr. Greenspan at 100 years old, who could, you know, move markets with his irrationally exuberant words. And so, and then the last thing I would say is the dollar is very strong, as it's, you know, up above 52 week highs, almost at 13 month highs at above 101 on the DXY. And that's different. It's different for the Trump administration. I've shown a bunch of charts where, you know, the dollar from 2016 to 2020 went down, and then the dollar again when he got elected for his second term started to go down. We obviously covered the failure of Doge and the continued expansion of money supply and the continued rise of the debts. And yet here we are with a dollar over 101. And that's really the factor. Everything else I set aside, yep. That's super strong dollar. I mean, just look at the correlations. Bitcoin down below 60,000. Silver, as you said, falling below 60. Gold, and especially the PGMs, essentially getting crushed in the short term. The unanswered question, or the unknowable thing for me, is how long. And so September.
It's an unknown known, though, so that's good. At least you know you don't know it.
Yeah, that's it. And Rumsfeld, Greenspan, all the people,
all the old hits. Coming
anyway,
back.
That's a long answer, and I think by the fall it gets resolved as we see that inflation comes down, and the Fed likely is not going to hike as much as the market is pricing in now, if at all.
I want to provide a bit of context for folks. $4,000 gold is a phenomenal price. Just a year ago, we were sitting around 3,200 and happy as all heck. I would like to remind people in the silver space that just a year ago, silver was trading at $35 an ounce. So if you're telling me the consolidation is going to be anywhere between $3,800 and $4,000 on the gold price before the next leg up, and be absolutely clear, near-term bearish because we broke through that support, absolutely midterm to long-term bullish, and that near-term bearish can change on a dime, right? And so it's important for everyone to understand that when Nick says he's short-term bearish, we're not talking, I mean, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be a year, sure. It also could be next week and everything changes on a dime, because that's the kind of market that we have right now. But again, context matters. A year ago, if you would have told me $55, $56, $57 silver was going to be the next bottom before the next leg up, I would have taken that, you know, in spades. Ditto for gold. Ditto for copper, right? So I think context is important. We did get a little bit ahead of ourselves in the gold space, in the silver space. It got frothy. That was back in January. Our portfolios were at all-time or at least 52-week highs just 6-7 months ago, folks. And so things can change quickly. I think it's important to have some context. And it's important, like you said, I tend to be mostly fully invested. That's just my approach. I also have a much higher level of risk tolerance than the average human being. And I deal with the upside of that, the downside of that, and I'm okay and content to take those punches and give those punches back. That doesn't have to be the approach, as Nick said, for all of you, right? We all have different needs, different wants, different commitments. And so you have to customize and tailor an approach that works for each of you individually. It's going to look different. So oftentimes we'll get subscribers writing in asking, you know, should I take profits? Should I add more? Should I hold? Should I sell? And look, I can tell you what I'm doing and why I like something or why I'm holding something or why I think I should be adding to something or why I'm selling something. But at the end of the day, what Gerardo Del Real needs to take care of his commitments might be different than what Jane in Washington needs. And so you have to kind of make sure that you're customizing that aspect of your portfolio management for yourself. You know, the broader themes, where gold goes, where silver goes, where copper goes, all of those things. We're happy to get in here and opine and talk technical levels and talk bullish trends and all of that and bearish trends. But your individual portfolio management really does have to be customized to your needs, folks. So hopefully you're doing that, and hopefully you sleep well with the decisions that you make with how much you are invested or how much capital you're allocating to this market. With that being said, I think the summer's a heck of an opportunity to add to positions. And it was interesting to me that even during the last drop where silver looked like it, you know, was going to touch 53, 54, and gold fell below 4,000, the juniors really didn't get sold off in the manner that you would expect. And I think a lot of that selling happened when the war started. And I think there's seller exhaustion out there to an extent. I think there's not a lot of buying coming in right now, but it was more the producers and the companies like a Perpetua Resources that are in index funds that were sold off the hardest because of the deleveraging that was going on in the metal space. Those companies took it on the chin a little more than some of the juniors did. And I'm seeing a lot of the juniors, if not surging back higher, at the very least trickling up back higher in both volume and price action, and or holding that base that they've made here over the last few weeks. So long-winded way of saying, I think it's a great opportunity to add. There's a lot of value out there. And we'll talk about some of that value here in the premium portion of the podcast. Anything you want to add on the copper side there, Nick? It touched six again briefly today, and we had some economic numbers that showed inflation in line with where we thought it would be, and it kind of showed everything else in line with where we thought it would be.
Yeah, I want to touch on what you said about what was getting sold off and when it sold off, and maybe why the small juniors, you know, the exploration names haven't maybe been sold off as harshly. I think there's a lot of algorithmic selling out there. I was reading this week that over half the investable capital in the market is now traded algorithmically, right? Yeah. And so when you get these technical triggers, whatever they are, the 50-day moving average of gold moving below the 200 moving day, the copper chart breaking down below near-term support, it automatically triggers selling. And maybe that doesn't happen in Moose Pasture Copper Corp Incorporated, but it definitely happens in, you know, like the COPEX ETF or ICOP or in managed futures and things like that. And so in some ways, selling begets selling. And so And what you were saying about there being deep value and things to take advantage of is true. And that goes against what the algorithms do, because we as humans aren't algorithmically programmed or machines. And in that sense, while we don't have a lot of advantages over flash trading and algorithms, one of the things that we do By way of the way we invest and the networks we have and our seat in the space is knowing the value of some of these companies and knowing when they are truly oversold and are at bargain prices. And there's definitely some bargains to be had out there now. So that was the only thing I would add to what you were saying there.
No. Well said. Back to my question on copper, which I'm looking at right now. Again, context matters, right? If you would have told me $5.95 copper was going to be the oh my God moment, I would have said I'll take $5.95 copper all day long. I'll take it, frankly, for the next several years. Though, again, like gold, like silver, like copper, I think it goes much, much higher here in the mid to long term. But thoughts on the technicals on copper there? It's a little trickier, right?
It's the chart looks better than gold and silver. It is technically bearish in the short term. Needs to hold around $5.90 or so. Is in a much stronger long-term uptrend. But the converse of that is it has a lot farther to fall to its trend line if that were to materialize. And I had a funny chart in the Underground Alpha issue that'll be out today. It said, I know what copper did last summer, and it had the little logo from the 1990s movie. Because last summer, at the end of July, copper went down by $1.30 in a single day at one point.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that, but it was on the back of tariff turmoil when Trump was going to tariff. He wasn't going to tariff. And then all that culminated in a Commerce Department Section 232 investigation, which we should be getting the report for any day now. And I think I touched on this a couple of weeks ago. Bloomberg had a really long article about it in which they didn't really conclude anything. I think I told you that. They said, oh, well, he could enact tariffs. He could not enact tariffs. He could do nothing. It's like, well, thanks for giving me the three options, right? But all that to say that it could lead to volatility in the copper space like we saw last summer. And so I have a short list back to what I was saying about knowing where the value is of companies that I would like to buy or add to. I have cash to do that because I've trimmed around some positions lately, not just in the commodity space. And I know what I would buy if and when that happens. And if it doesn't, I'm content to own what I have in the copper positions that I have exposure to now. So I don't know if that gives you an answer or not, but at the end of the day, all these metals are long-term bullish for well, not forever, but from the lens of we're halfway through or 60% through a super cycle that still needs to bear itself out. And we're only 10% through, if that, of the reshoring and the producing of the metals that we need here at home relative to what China produces and isn't letting the rest of the world have, whether that's copper or rare earths or tungsten or antimony or whatever it is, right? So still a long road to hoe in terms of that, and no matter how it plays out in the short term.
Couldn't agree more. Frankly, China couldn't agree more with us. Just this week again, it's decided to flex its, you know, monopolizing muscle by restricting, you know, essentially all of the heavy rare earth magnets to all of the companies that could possibly be in position to produce these things, right? And look, it's one thing to be able to find these deposits and extract the metals and separate them. You know, it's extremely complicated. It's one thing to be able to do that. It's another thing to find the talent, and we've talked about this before, to sustain that and to establish critical metal supply chains over any amount of time. Japan's been trying to do this for 15 years, and there's still something like 80% or had 80% of its rare earth supplies restricted over the past 12 months by China. Not a coincidence that companies like Energy Fuels, and we'll give you all a freebie on that one. It's a company that Nick covers that he's guided his subscribers well on, but you know, they just got a $725 million loan, essentially a commitment, I should say, of funding to help accelerate the production and the establishment of these critical metal supply chains. And what they do, they immediately went out and spent $1.9 billion dollars on acquiring a company that's going to integrate a lot of the ingredients that they need to become that dominant force or a dominant force here in the United States. So if you're wondering, you know, whether this rare earth bull market or this lithium bull market or this uranium bull market has legs and is sustainable, just look at what China's buying. They'll tell you. There's just a report on gold. They've added for their 19th month in a row, 19th month in a row to their gold holdings. They're not slowing down because we broke through technical levels. They could care less. They get it cheaper. And so, yes, it's tough when your portfolio is down 50 or 60% over the summer and not a lot is happening in the portfolio. Although I will say, if you have the right companies, a lot is actually happening. We'll get into that later on. But there's a lot of great exploration work being done, a lot of value being added. You just have to keep an eye on that aspect of it and be patient. And again, the hardest thing to do in this space, especially if you're impatient like I am, I love catalysts, I love action, I'm always ready to go. The hardest thing sometimes is just to sit back and watch it happen, right? It feels like watching paint dry, but slowly but surely, catalysts are materializing. And again, we'll talk about that in the premium portion of the podcast here a little bit later on.
Yeah, that was some really big news from Energy Fuels. And the Bloomberg article this week that you were talking about said that essentially all year, the imports of tungsten and magnet-related materials, including dysprosium and terbium, have essentially been at zero going into Japan. And, you know, Japan and the West have been dealing with this for over a decade at this point, since China did this back in the 2010, 2012 timeframe. And they've been unable to figure it out. And yeah, we've talked about this a lot. It's hard to process these rare earths. It's dirty to process these rare earths. It's difficult to separate them and get the ones that are of value. You've got, you know, different types of metals, lanthanides, et cetera, and they don't easily separate. And you end up having to separate ones that aren't valuable, which brings the value of the process down. It gives you waste streams that you have to deal with. And the West hasn't been able to figure that out. Japan's doing some interesting things with, I don't know if you know, they're like robot mining in the sea. They started a project this year for rare earths. I'm in a recycling company that has done well and is now in the process of building a recycling center with a hub and spoke process in Tejas, where you live. And the Energy Fuels deal was a big deal. So as you mentioned, over $700 million in government support, and then spent $1 billion to essentially bolt on that last piece, right? So Energy Fuels has mines that they have and projects that they're in the process of acquiring across the globe in Australia and Madagascar, monazite sands, etc., that they're going to then process. And that's the second part, which they already have in Utah with the White Mesa Mill. And then the last part of that is, you know, what do you do once you have the individual elements? Well, you've got to turn them into magnets, right? And that's what they did with this most recent $1 billion acquisition. And so there's a lot to like with that company. They've now got all the pieces of the puzzle, even more so, I would argue, than MP Materials has.
Absolutely.
And yeah. And this was a $5 stock just last year. I mean, early last year in like January, we were buying it at $5 and $6. It went as high, I don't know, the 52-week high, but it was over $20. And but then it's pulled back. It's around $14 US now, and definitely one to look at as the US and the West get serious about securing these supply chains and figuring out how to do it. And again, it's not a 1 month or a 1 year thing. This is like a decade long thing, right? So a lot of runway left on this rare earth thing, I think.
Yeah, well said. Meanwhile, we have the National Guard guarding the reflecting pool and arresting people for taking paint chips from it. And they can't figure out how the fuck to get this thing from green to blue again after painting it blue and then having the Secret Service run over it while all of it was still fresh and the sealant hadn't even dried. And listen, I'm the guy that could barely change a tire. I might not be able to change a tire, but even I'm not dumb enough to be look at that and get that job done and then say, yeah, go run and drive over it and then go try to blame people and threaten them with 10 years of imprisonment. For going and seeing the reflective pool. They chased some little 10-year-old kid that was putting his hand in the water. The National Guard with, you know, the big semi-automatic rifle comes up. He's like, what are you doing? The parent looked at the National Guard guy like, what is wrong with you guys? Like, it's absolutely insane. And then just the audacity with which this administration lies to the American public, right? I mean, to just get out there and say the stuff that they say and then repeat it. It's absolutely it's impressive. I'll give them that. I mean, they stick to their lies, but man, it's again, the reflecting pool being a swamp is such a metaphor for where we are here in this 250th year of this great country. I've been watching I'm a geek at heart, right? And at night I'll have a drink, and if I'm having a drink, I get curious about documentaries. I love documentaries. And I was watching one on Ulysses Grant last week, and then I just started one on Jefferson. They're both on Netflix. Very well done documentaries. And I'm looking at the founding fathers, and I'm reading some of their, like, you know, documents and declarations and bills, and looking at what they did in a time that was a much simpler time, you would think. And then I compare with where we are now with our politicians and our Supreme Court. We'll get into that in a little bit. Don't like cancer? Too bad, right? You can't sue nobody for giving it to you. But I was contrasting that with where we are now. And it's, man, if this isn't the fourth turning for our country, I don't know what is. But we're most definitely, I think, on the tail end of it turning up. I'm the eternal optimist. I'm hopeful that, you know, we're maybe 4 or 5 years from like a significant, let's call it a re-rating for America, right? And there's a lot wrong, but there's still a lot right, and there's a lot that could be better, and you know, I hope to be around to contribute to that part of it. But yeah, crazy times, man.
I'll try to save some of my political stuff into the bizarro section, but could you imagine the things that Trump and the MAGA cohort would be saying if it were Kamala spending tens of millions of dollars on White House decorating, rebuilding projects and redoing the reflecting pool? I mean, it would be, I mean, the things that would come out of their mouth would be atrocious, right? And yet here we are getting fed the stuff from Mr. Trump, who is rebuilding the things and redoing the lawn. And I get that pools are tough to maintain. You're a pool owner. I'm a pool owner. But at the end of the day, it is, at least it provides for some comic relief, if not tragic from the lens of efficiency and monetary spending.
What Robin Williams say? I laugh to keep myself from crying sometimes, right? man, look, last but not least, I want to highlight one other company, and I should do this on the premium portion, but I'm going to do it here because it ties into the energy fuels funding commitment. Generation Mining, which has a very good palladium, copper, zinc asset in Canada, just received a $200 million commitment from the Canada Infrastructure Bank. So for anyone that thinks that the race to secure these critical metals and these metals that are necessary for today's and future economies, that it's just an American thing or a US-centric thing or a Chinese thing, absolutely not. Canada, for all its governmental and budget woes and flaws, is absolutely clear, at least on this end of it, that they need to be able to secure projects that have scale, that have life, that have the potential to contribute to its economy. And so, again, not a coincidence that Generation Mining now has something like 85% of its funding package to build that project, some $965 million, if I'm not mistaken, Canadian. Congrats to that team for getting that done. That was no easy feat. I remember talking with Kerry Knoll, the executive chairman, last year at the Beaver Creek Precious Metal Summit, And he was oozing and radiating confidence that he could get that done. He talked about the last deal he had gotten financed, and he said, this one's 10 times simpler than that one, and they need the stuff 10 times more than they needed this other one. He's like, this one will be a piece of cake for me. And, you know, true to his word, they've done everything they said they were going to do and are now in position to begin building this thing here in the very, very near term. So kudos and congrats to that company. You want a good base metal play with a great copper kicker and some zinc to go with that. Generation Mining is a good company to look at, especially at current levels, given where they're at. It's been de-risked.
Yeah, it's in the Underground Alpha portfolio. I am a shareholder. It's still not getting the recognition and the valuation it deserves. So a couple of things on Generation. This was a 28-cent stock a year ago. It went up to 90-some cents, right? So it tripled heading into to this year. And has since pulled back as they've executed on these financing packages. It's pulled back from 80, 90 cents to start 2026 to about 65 cents today. It did pop in the past couple of weeks up to 75 cents as they made these subsequent announcements putting the financing package together. But it's back down at 65 cents. And I was writing today that I've got a bid in to buy some more. It's in fact more than 85% secured. So the feasibility study, which was done in March last year, calls for, can you tell I was writing about this today? Calls for $992 million Canadian of CapEx. And they've got $969 million of that secured. Some of that comes from Wheaton Precious Metals, who you've got to assume like $200 million of it, who you've got to assume has done their due diligence. In fact, it was $240 million from Wheaton. They've already advanced $40. And then you've got some of the banks, including those that we talked about with like PMET a couple of weeks ago or last week, French banks like Société Générale, ING, et cetera. It's the first time the Canadian Infrastructure Bank has invested in a critical metals project in Ontario. So I just mentioned a feasibility study from March last year. I think that pegged it at just over $1 billion NPV at the prices it used in the feasibility study. If you plug in current spot prices, it's over a $2 billion net present value on this project. And the market cap is about $200 million, right? So you can do the math on the disparity between the valuation that the Generation is fetching and the net present value given current metals prices. Plus, there's a lot to like in general with the infrastructure that's there. They've got power. They've got a rail line. This thing's not in the middle of nowhere. So a lot to like and seemingly shovel ready at this point. Likely we'll have to do a little bit of top up on the equity side to bridge that gap from the 970 million they have to the 992 they need. But looks like a project that's going to get built for sure.
Absolutely. So there you go. Y'all got a freebie and you got a breakdown by both Nick and myself. That was well done, Mr. Hodge. Appreciate it. What else is there to talk about on the market side? I want to talk about on the societal side. I want to get into some of the elections that happened in New York and, you know, kind of the trend that's happening there and why it's happening. And I most definitely want to touch on the Supreme Court decision, who basically said, look, hey, if Monsanto poisoned you with cancer, with its Roundup that they knew caused cancer and that they still went out and sprayed all over your farms and all over your crops and all over your yards, you don't get to sue them. Damn cancer victim people. You could just take your cancer and just deal with it.
You want to get into it? The only other market thing I would mention is uranium in the $17.5 billion from the federal government. We can do it real quick and then we can move on. And it's in the same vein as the rare earths. They're now funding, you know, the problem with uranium is that it costs whatever, 10, 15, in the case of those the Georgia plants that I think it was Southern Company built recently, like $30 billion, right? And there's always cost overrun. So it's like chicken and egg. Like they don't want to build the projects because they cost so much, and they cost so much because nobody puts up the capital to create sort of like the rare earths, the economies of scale that are needed to build these things. So the government is now saying, we'll put up $17 billion to fund some of these long lead time items, specifically for Westinghouse AP Reactors, which you'll recall did a deal with Cameco a couple of years ago now, maybe 2 or 3 years ago now. And there was another like $80 billion thing floating around for them to build these new reactors as a combined entity. So hopefully that will kickstart some projects and make it a little easier for these utilities to commit. Now, the utilities are still going to have to commit. They're going to have to still put up some capital as well. But you can see the writing on the wall as far as what the government wants to do by fast-tracking the permitting of uranium projects, by backing these nuclear projects with this most recent loan, by, speaking of the 4th of July and the 250th anniversary, you know, having like a checklist of wanting to have four, you know, small modular reactors reaching criticality by then. So, and at the same time, everything applies to the uranium sector that we talked about earlier with copper, like getting cheaper has sold off over the past couple of weeks. And there's definitely some value presented there. So sorry, I wanted to sneak that in. Now happy to talk about whatever you want to talk about
on the societal side. Yeah. And now I'm going to sneak one last thing in and then we'll get to it. Right. Just to kind of put a cherry on top or a bow on it. There's a breaking headline about a half an hour ago, right before we started this podcast, that the U.S. government is now green lighting critical metals plants on U.S. military bases. So if, again, some of these trends, you don't have to be the brightest bulb in the box or the most articulate, or you don't have to be, you know, some hedge fund guru to see the direction that the trend is going in and the fact that we're going to need a lot of this stuff moving forward. And you know, our job, obviously, through our multiple publications is to get ahead of that and find companies that can find these deposits and that can then, you know, develop them, finance them, and get them to market, each at a different stage. And then Nick and I approach that, you know, I'm more aggressive on the exploration side. And Nick kind of plays it, you know, kind of from farm to table, right? The whole shebang there. So whatever your preference is, whatever your appetite is for that, that's what our job is at the end of the day when it comes to the publishing side of the business and the newsletter side, is finding ideas that are going to benefit and profit, and by default, we profit from, in the market by getting ahead of these trends. The trends are super clear right now. It's just having the wherewithal to let, you know, pullbacks like the one we're going through right now work themselves through. They always do. Know what you own. And yeah, there you go. That's my spiel on that.
It can be testing at times for sure.
Well, let's get to it. New York has a mayor that is incredibly popular there. Not so much with big business, which says it's leaving. We'll see if they leave. But most definitely with the young voter base. And, you know, whatever you feel about the current New York mayor's approach, murders are down, assaults are down, a number of things are down. So he is delivering on that front. We could have a debate about how that's being done. We could have a debate on the social implications of accepting socialism as a viable policy in American politics. And frankly, look, I'm a capitalist at heart, right? I'm a proud capitalist at heart. I'm also, I lean deeply libertarian. So clearly I have a lot of conflict and issue with the socialist aspect of what's happening in New York and what's happening in other places. I think the reason it's been successful thus far in terms of getting people elected, we'll see what the results are, right, over time, is because people, just like with Donald Trump, just wanted something new, man. Like, the old stuff isn't working. Like, they keep jerking everyone around, keep taxing people more. People keep dying. There's a report that the U.S. government allowed an insane amount of fentanyl in last year because it was making cases on bigger busts that then never materialized. So when you look at all that, if you're the average citizen in New York and murders are up at the time and assaults are up and the streets are dirty and you're getting taxed to death and you're working two jobs just to pay the babysitter, you might say, what do I got to lose with this little socialist guy or this little socialist gal? Just like MAGA in 2016 and again here in 2024 said, should have known better in 2024, y'all, by the way. But just like MAGA said, what do we have to lose? No wars? Cut the deficit down? Invest in America, America First, all of that was brilliant marketing, and it sounded great because in practice would have been a good policy had we actually stuck to it. We've gotten the complete opposite, hence the disillusionment on all sides. It's not just, I know lots of, you know, Republicans in our space that were like the biggest Trump supporters at conferences, and I see them on X now and Twitter, and I'm like, is this the same so-and-so from like 2 years ago that was just like all about MAGA, right? They're like completely on the other end of it going, I can't believe we were so betrayed by the administration. The Epstein files, don't get me going on that. I'm not done with that yet, by the way. We'll leave that for another day, but that still hasn't happened. So I say all that to say that I think the reason that this is happening in New York and other places is people are just fed up, man. And they're like, well, what's the worst that can happen? We're already getting it always but sideways, you know, from the current government. Let's see what comes out of this. And again, it cuts both ways. We'll see what the results are when it's all said and done, but it's a heck of a social experiment for sure.
I mean, it's certainly a complex issue, and I feel like even sometimes I feel differently about it on different days. You put it well. I mean, people are losing their shit and have been for a decade now on both sides of the aisle, and or even more than that. And it's easy to see why, given however you want to frame it, the wealth inequality, the no controls on your politicians and elected officials, them using the office to enrich themselves, the rich getting richer, the cost of everything going up and it getting harder to get ahead. And so it's easy to see. I mean, I founded something called the Outsider Club based on all of that, right? Because didn't want to be part of it on either side. But the bell curve being the bell curve, folks have gravitated to different solutions or narratives or tribes that give them dog whistles or red meat that sounds good to them, even though it might not be so good on in practice. And there's evidence of that on both sides of the aisle. I think that going back to your Supreme Court and the roundup in Monsanto, I think that Citizens United back in 2010 did a lot to harm this country, and treating businesses like people has really been one of the things that contributed to this tribalism and breaking down of the American political system. And so I get why people gravitate towards Trump. I get why people gravitate towards and Mr. Mamdani and Bernie Sanders and those types of figures on the left. And it doesn't change the history that on both sides, like fascism hasn't really worked, and socialism certainly hasn't worked. You know, what's the quote? Like, at a certain point, you run out of
everyone else's money,
other people's money, right? And at some point, I would like, and I was talking to Rick Rule about this earlier this week. I interviewed him, and the first question I asked was about where we live here in Washington State, because I've heard him say in a couple of interviews that, again, shameless plug, we're heading to the Rule Symposium in 9 days, and it's in Boca Raton, Florida. And in anticipation of that, he's been doing a lot of interviews. And I've heard him say in a couple of those interviews that he's meeting with realtors while he's in Florida because of taxes that have recently been passed in Washington State. And I was asking him about that, and he says it's a tough decision. To leave a place that you like to live, where you like people. And yet, in some of these instances, whether it be New York or Washington or Illinois, which you're familiar with, or Taxachusetts, as it's known, people are definitely leaving. I mean, I look at $1 million, $2 million listings here in Spokane County and in Seattle as well, and they're definitely on the rise. Like Rick anecdotally said that folks in his circles are definitely moving to places like Idaho and to Florida, and that doesn't solve the issue of rampant spending, which definitely has to come down because it hasn't been effective. I mean, you can just look at like all the money they being the government have thrown at things like education and some of these welfare programs that have one not had the intended effects. If you look at the test scores, for example, too have been now known to be ripe with fraud in many cases. And I'm not saying like, fuck them kids. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's got to be spent efficiently and wisely. And you've got to be able to admit when more money is not the solution. And it seems like the left is not willing to admit that, because all I hear is we want more. We want to spend more. And we want more of what you have. And if you have it, you're a villain. That's what I hear when I hear them talk. I get that maybe in some cases the revenue has to go up. And I think that there's smarter ways to do that. Going back to how I started talking about Citizens United at the company level. And I say that as an owner of two businesses, right? There's definitely a happy medium there. But to vilify folks that are creating the jobs and have done well for themselves, especially, and I've said this a million times, not the 0.01%, not the 0.1%, but those in that 9%, that top 9% that gets swept up in it. There's a lot of bad taste in people's mouth for that. So that was a bit of a rant there, but we'll see how the socialism thing plays out. I mean, I can see MAGA starting to wane a little bit. We'll see how much traction the socialism stuff garners. But they definitely won some elections in New York, even against some Democratic-backed, like Hakeem Jeffries-backed candidates that lost to these up-and-coming self-proclaimed socialists. And then the stuff you hear coming out of their mouths, not all of them, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but I was reading last night, you know, one of them who was elected is talking about like nationalizing the airlines, for example. And it's like, good luck with that, man. Like, we know how that game ends, right? Yeah. I mean, so
we've seen that anyway, movie.
Exactly. So all that to say, these are complex problems, and they're going to take complex or maybe not complex solutions, but they're going to take a changing of the system so that we change the way the game is played and we don't revert to tribalism and extremes on both sides, because that's not where it's at.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Supreme Court was busy today with a lot of decisions. The one that I was the most offended by was the decision, the Monsanto decision, right? To make sure that they cannot be liable, even if they are. Like, you can't even argue it in court now. You can't even take them to court and sue them for causing you or your loved ones cancer. It's insane, man. It's just insane kind of where we're at. We talk about activist judges, and I hear Elon get on his high horse every time a minority commits a crime, and, you know, he highlights every minority crime that he can possibly find. And he talks about, you know, activist judges and how all these activist judges are just ruining the country and how we got to get them out of there. And then I look at the Supreme Court and the decisions today, and I'm like, the highest court in the land is nothing but activist judges right now, y'all.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing?
I mean, yeah, I could talk about this a little bit more because I like talking about this sort of stuff. But like, did you see the guy, I think it was in North Carolina, who stabbed the blonde chick in the neck on the train a year or two ago? Did you see that? Just I
absolutely.
Think it was like a couple fucking of weeks horrible. Ago, he was deemed, you know, not suitable to stand trial, right? But yet, in the same system, he was deemed suitable to be out on the street. Like, you can't, like, that doesn't compute,
yeah,
right?
No.
In someone's
no.
mind.
Yeah, that young lady should not be dead.
This is going to be all over the place. But and then I listen to people like Fetterman from Pennsylvania, who I actually like sometimes, like, because he votes with the Republicans sometimes. And I like people who will vote on both sides of the aisle. And like, I think he was responding to something Larry David said this week about the UFC fights. And Larry David said, you know, he's not proud to be American. And Fetterman was saying, like, all right, like, this guy's an idiot, not Larry David, but like, maybe Trump or the Republicans, and like, yeah, these fights might be dumb, but like, that doesn't mean I'm not proud to be an American, right? Like, I still take pride in where I'm from and in our country, and I think that guy makes a lot of sense. And then onto the Supreme Court, well, first on Monsanto and the Roundup, like, that stems back to that Citizens United and the protecting of corporations, and just a little bit close to home, I mentioned my in-laws are in town. And we're going to the Hoop Fest this weekend. You know, in Maryland, where I'm from, there's a company called Gore who makes Gore-Tex, which a lot of people are familiar with. And it's now coming out that for a long time, they were letting chemicals go into the atmosphere and into the local water sources that have caused a lot of problems for a lot of folks, including my mother-in-law, who was down a kidney because of kidney issues that were caused because of the forever chemicals that were in her water. She not only worked at Gore for a couple of decades, but she lived across the street from one of the manufacturing plants. And the lawsuits that have stemmed from that, and this has been ongoing for like 3 years now, get drug out because Gore has the ability to drag it out. It's one of the largest employers in the county where I'm from. And so Maryland is trying to sue Gore, but I don't have a lot of faith that that's going to happen. And yeah. There's a separate suit from the people who were affected, who owned homes around there. And this is right up the Roundup Alley, right? This is sort of like the same thing. I mean, they're going to end up settling for a fraction of what they likely deserve. That's my opinion. It's not done yet, but we'll see how it goes. And that just seems to be the way the system and the court system is set up in this country to protect the corporations. And that's sad. That being said, I think the Supreme Court got some stuff right, like especially on the Second Amendment. Like,
I'm all for
with with the cannabis stuff recently that says, you know, no, like you can smoke cannabis and own a firearm. Like those two things aren't mutually exclusive. And the one, I think it was just today, in Hawaii, saying that you don't have to have permission of a property owner that has public access, basically a store. Like you don't have to ask the store permission to carry a firearm inside of their things. And I'm no court scholar, obviously. I was just doing a little bit of reading because we're at the end of the Supreme Court's term and there's a lot of cases that are coming out fast and furious. They are going to check. And by the way, I think three or four of the Supreme Court justices, I think it's three, were appointed in Trump's first term. So you talk about activist judges or you talk about stacking the court, but they are going to check him. Like, he's not going to get away with ending birthright citizenship. Like, they're going to put the kibosh on that. And he's not going to be allowed to fire Lisa Cook. Like, they're going to rule like he's not allowed to do that. So they are going to check him. And in that way, going back to what you were saying about the founding fathers, like, they set up a pretty good system that's not perfect, but the checks and balances from your eighth grade social studies class definitely still come into play. And then maybe a little bit more controversial is the transgender thing, which we haven't got the ruling on yet, but I'm pretty confident they're going to say, by all means, Idaho and West Virginia can not let men or boys play in girls' sports, because that's just one of the most common sense things that I've seen. And we continue to see the cases, and I've been wanting to rant about this for a while. So sorry, like as a father of two daughters who play sports, and as I see boys, I'm not even going to frame it, like, because in the media now they call them, you know, transgenders, or they call them by their female name. Like, no, man, like X and Y chromosomes and testicles and vaginas, like, we shouldn't be letting these boys win state championships in individual girls' sports. There's a case here in Washington recently where on a wrestling mat, a boy, as a girl, stuck his fingers up another girl's vagina while he was wrestling her. And the girl at the time said, like, during the match, like, hey, like, this person, she didn't know it was a boy, and I'll get to that in a second. There's fingers in my vagina. Like, she said it during the wrestling match, and it comes out later that it's a transgender, and the state won't let the family sue because you assume the risk. Like, when you go to wrestle, you assume that there's going to be fingers in your orifices, whether or not it's a boy or a girl, right? And then it came out that it was a boy after the fact, right? And so some of that stuff is on the ballot here in Washington this fall. And anyway, that's one of the common sense things that I think the Supreme Court is going to get right. Whether that translates into other states like California and Washington remains to be seen. But that's where I think the left goes wrong a little bit and loses folks like me who would otherwise be sympathetic to some of their policies and causes.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree with that 100%. Again, I don't like a lot about the left right now, and I don't like a lot about the right right now. And I think the whole thing has to an extent, get restructured and reinvigorated. And we have to get back to critical thinking and community and common sense, and got to get the money out of politics. And yeah, I won't get on another rant about AIPAC and the money and The guy in New York that lost, they called the winner. They called the people that voted for the other guy anti-Semitic. Only problem there was is the guy that won was also Jewish. He just wasn't AIPAC funded. And again, you can't just say anti-Semitic about everything. I got called an anti-Semite earlier this week for posting a real story out of concern for 70. And we talked about this about a week or two ago. There were 71 schoolgirls that were allegedly on a field trip and allegedly were gone for a couple of hours and emerged from underground sewer, like tunnels. Real story, like produced by CBS and ABC. And, you know, the heads there are Jewish. It's Barry Weiss, and it's, you know, the owners are Jewish. It was nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It was all to do about girl safety and what the fuck is going on that 71 girls on a field trip would go missing for a couple of hours and emerge from the sewer. Anybody that doesn't think that's odd or strange or care enough about those schoolgirls to ask a question is a little off to me. Anybody that takes that and says, you're spreading online hate, that's anti-Semitic, and then blocks me and doesn't allow for discourse or an opinion back or a comment. And it's disappointing because I know this person. I actually like this person. Like, we've had many pleasant conversations. This person should know more about my character than to say that. And I don't want to make this about me, but my point is, it's become a trend to just play the race card or play the anti-Semite card. And yeah, back to your point about the young blonde girl that was killed by the mentally now insane black guy. Look, I don't care if it would have been the other way around. If a crazy blonde blue-eyed girl went up to, you know, a big Nigerian man that was sitting down sleeping, minding his own business, and stabbed him a bunch of times and killed him, I'd be calling for her to get executed. It has nothing to do with race, folks. It has to do with wrong is wrong and right is right. To always lean towards, well, if you say this about this group, then you're automatically this because we don't like the opinion. Not like the opinion all you want. But on this one, it was a little, like, I was slightly offended, but I didn't even take it to heart because I'm looking at this like, oh, that's your perspective of the world. Got it. Like, anyone reporting a real story that happens to have anybody that may be of the Jewish faith or from the background is automatically anti-Semitic if you don't like it. But if you do like it, then you're a supporter and you're great and you're going to heaven. I don't know. I don't know what people think, man.
That's that tribalism. Yeah, no. And Israel's done a really good job of whatever, using propaganda or using media in that way to claim anyone who criticizes, whether constructively or not, or wants a discourse to pull that, as you say, race card or gender card, or in this case, anti-Semite card, right? And I've got to get beyond that in this country for sure if we're going to get to some of those common sense or complex solutions that are going to fix this whole mess. So agreed. Anyway, that was a wonderful discussion.
Hey, loved that. Enjoyed that. Should we get to the premium portion of the podcast? We should, right? Okay, let's get to it. We do got to talk about iPhone birth control and Pope AI next week. We promise, folks, we'll get that to you. But no, premium portion of the podcast. I am Gerardo Del Real along with Mr. Nick Hodge. This was the 370th episode of our weekly therapy session we call Investing in Bizarro World. Have a great, great, great week out there, everyone.
See ya.